So here we are. It's episode. I've lost count.
It's episode 17, Robin. Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers. How has your half term been?
I haven't had a half term because I work in a proper job now, as my mother used to say. I love the idea that like teaching wasn't a proper job.
I hate it when people say proper job. It drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I have had an excellent week. I did go away, been abroad for the first time for a while. I actually went Brilliant. Skiing and the weather was perfect.
So you started at the top of a gradient that was presumably about 15 degrees and you were on frictionless skis and the length of the slope was, I'm guessing about a kilometre. So using Suvat, how fast did you get out?
Quite fast. It wasn't frictionless though. But I was out on my bike today and I was thinking the wind in my ears on the bike was much less than the wind in my ears on my skis. So I reckon I went a lot faster on skis than I do on a push bike. Anyhow, enough flim flam. We should talk about physics in the news. We've had a quick chat before recording. We both came up with neutron stars, but completely different things. So you were reading Scientific American?
Scientific American was where it's at for me. Yeah, I do like Scientific American. Trouble is New Scientist, because it's a weekly, I always just feel really bad because I only get to sort of see a couple of the articles in there. But Scientific American's about the right length for a month's worth for me. We know neutron stars are this amazing degenerate matter, this collapse of the whole of the atomic structure, and the electrons merge with the protons and make neutrons, and it just packs into one massive great neutron nucleus, pretty much. And they've got a lovely stat in here. They say that a piece of a neutron star the size of a ping pong ball would weigh more than a billion metric tons. Wow. But of course, seeing inside them is immensely challenging, and they've just started to make some interesting inroads into working out what's happening beneath the surface of a neutron star.
Yeah, that's a homework I set every year, actually, when I'm getting into talking about nuclear. I set a homework, just go home. Would the mass of all the human beings on the surface of the Earth fit in a teaspoon?
Wow.
And if you go away and do it, usually the mean of the class is about 5 mil, which is a teaspoon.
Wow.
It's a good estimating challenge.
That is a good estimating challenge, isn't it? That's amazing.
So, yeah, so I think your article is all about what a neutron star is, but mine is in the good old Economist, that famous scientific magazine.
Yes, I like the Economist science. Again, it's another good summary of what the big breakthroughs, isn't it?
And they talk about, they give an introduction to neutron stars, but they talk about what the heavy elements, there are too many elements like gold and platinum and uranium. And because a supernova, however powerful it is, doesn't seem to be powerful enough to make these heavy elements in the abundance we see. So where do they come from? And the answer is neutron stars. This is a brilliant thing. When two neutron stars smash into each other, in a very rare event, which has a special name, which I can't, it's something like, what is it?
Kilonova.
Kilonova.
Yeah.
They smash into each other, fragments go everywhere, and the neutrons, it's almost like bombarding elements with neutron beam. And you can change them because the neutrons enter the nucleus and then they decay and they become a proton and you're raising the atomic number. And that explains why there are more of the heavier elements like gold and platinum. And well, it's a really interesting link to LIGO, because when they saw that LIGO collision and they pointed their telescopes at it, looked at the spectra and saw there were more of the heavy elements in that area of space. So
brilliant. So we get the heavy elements through basically neutron bombardment of neutrons that came from a collision of two neutron stars.
Yeah, a kilonova. And that reminded me of a podcast. I don't know if you've heard of the podcast Science-ish. Very good podcast.
There are other podcasts in science? I don't think so.
This was very good. Won awards and everything. They talked about LIGO because there has been some controversy about the LIGO detection and whether it's real or not. The best thing to do is listen to the podcast on Science-ish. Is LIGO right? If you're interested to find out about that very interesting podcast.
Brilliant. Okay, Science-ish, a fellow podcast. Obviously, you know, they'll be sitting there thinking, oh, wow, we've had a mention on the Physics Teaching Podcast. We've made it now. I was reading the other day, apparently we're the 153rd most popular education podcast in the UK, I guess. I don't know.
Education, 153rd.
Yeah, 153rd. I think the virtual fist bump over the airwaves here. That's great. Thank you, dear listener.
Your prediction of me selling 4,000 vacuum cannons has sadly not come true, but we have sold some.
How many we sold? How many have we sold?
Three.
Three, yes.
And there'll be five or six left in the shop. And then once we've sold them, we'll have covered our costs. All will be good in the world.
I think we should heavily promote them in Russia. We'll start a vacuum cannon arms race.
It's interesting, the properties of vacuum, actually, because I'm about to teach flywheels. And there's some great stuff on flywheels that are run in a vacuum, suspended on magnetic fields, low friction. And I watched this video, and they're using it to offset the power from the grid in America. So if they've got no wind, they've stored it as kinetic energy. And I just estimated from watching this video the energy stored in one flywheel at the speed they said. It was like 12 megajoules.
My goodness.
Flywheel was about as big as me. Amazing. Amazing.
Brilliant.
Just brilliant.
That is phenomenal. This reminds me, because somebody was talking to me the other day and saying, oh, you know, it's really difficult when you know, physics isn't your subject, but you have to teach it. How do you kind of hack? How do you spoof being a physics teacher? And these anecdotes that we sort of discuss in physics in the news every week, these are kind of it, aren't they? This is it. Just, you know, kind of pick up Scientific American, pick up The Economist, look at the BBC Science site, just try and find something interesting that's happened in physics and go, oh, yeah, did you see that? There's a huge flywheel with 12 megajoules. Just things like that. It lays it out there for the kids, doesn't it?
Well, I've faked being a physics teacher for over 25 years using anecdotes that I've picked up from podcasts recently and from economists and stuff. It's absolutely, this is what you must do.
He's lying about his age, listener. He's lying about his age.
I'm certainly lying about being a physicist. We all know. I've hinted at it several times in the podcast. I certainly don't have a physics degree. I've got half an engineering degree, but I muddle through.
No, you do really well. No, it's brilliant. And that's the other thing, of course, is it is really important that we all don't get too snobby about it. It's so interesting at the Institute of Physics, we do lots of things and we do interviews for teaching scholars and all these sorts of things. And some of the physics teachers that we have who are physics specialists with physics degrees and at least two ones in physics as well, because otherwise they wouldn't get to the interview stage, they still get, you know, really simple physics concepts wrong because they've always had that misconception with them. And it's worth pointing out that all of us are carrying some misconceptions. We don't know them until we identify them as misconceptions because we can't explain something or somebody asks us a question that reveals it. But that's the nature of the beast. All of us, no matter how much of a physicist we are, we still have things that we don't understand. I think I was talking before, wasn't it, about moon phases? I still didn't get the moon phases until relatively recently, till I started teaching.
We've mentioned this before. I think the jelly chair came out of a chat about you telling me that people who are being interviewed at the IOP didn't know the difference between a force pair and a reaction pair, or whatever you call them. I saw an interesting thread on Twitter actually about that. What do you actually call those pairs? That we don't have official language for that, do we, in physics?
No, it's difficult, and the terminology often trips you up and introduces more misconceptions than it causes. And of course, energy is the big one of those. We'll be talking about that one episode in the future very soon, I'm sure.
I'm sure we will get around to that. A bit scared of that.
Stores and transfers, yeah.
So what tips would you have for some lucky person who's not a physics specialist who is being forced to teach, I don't know, 11-year-olds physics? I mean, what would, if they approach you in the corridor, what would you have said back in the day when you were actually in the classroom?
Well, I think we talked about anecdotes there. That's one I'd say, you know, just find stuff in the news and just say, oh, you're in this area, you know, this sort of thing. That's one we talked about. Definitely do that. I think there's another one that you'll like, which is practical work. Don't be scared of it. You will be scared of it because you're not familiar with it. You don't know what's going on. But just get in there, get your hands dirty, have a few disasters, but work through them and work on. There's loads of videos online and things like that to help you. If you look up Alom Shaha online, great videos on how to, and they're pitched at teachers on how to do practicals. So keep the practical work going. And the other thing is enthusiasm. Even if you don't feel the enthusiasm, fake it. You know, just basically you are their physics teacher. So they are looking to you for exposure to the world of physics, so you carry that responsibility with you. So please make sure, you know, you do it in a positive way, even if you don't feel very positive about it.
I'd certainly be positive, because there will be kids in every class who are very interested in physics, and being positive about it helps them a lot. I obviously totally agree with you about practical work. Don't be scared of it. If you're not doing practicals as a non-specialist, the technicians will be very keen to help. I've never met a technician who isn't keen for more practicals to happen. Maybe we'll get some flames on Twitter for that, but no, technicians I've worked with always want to see the practicals happening for the kids, and they're more than willing to help. So
absolutely,
if you're a non-specialist, do please consider doing some simple practicals and ask experienced teachers for help. They don't have to be physicists. There'll be plenty of people in the department who've taught physics over the years who can guide you.
Yeah, technicians are absolutely essential, and I can't sing their praises enough. I just think that they're wonderful, sainted people who don't get the recognition they deserve. So, yeah, absolutely agree with you there. In terms of that, I suppose we could also probably be a little bit more helpful here than sort of vague exhortations by talking a little bit about what happens when practicals go wrong, what happens when practicals fail. Because I think, sorry to do this to you, put you on the spot. This is because I would have had countless failed practicals in the last week.
I had a terrible week the week before half term with practicals going wrong. It's an ideal time. I went into half term very glum.
Yeah, well, sorry to do the post-traumatic stress thing, but talking through it will help you.
Okay, so yeah, we did that podcast on diffraction, and I got very enthused about diffraction and the ripple tank because I have a sort of love-hate relationship with ripple tanks. I would love someone to come on the podcast and tell me how to use a ripple tank properly. I would really, really value that. Let's have an episode, how to use a ripple tank.
We'll have to get Nikki back.
I had a beautiful shadow on the ceiling. I can put coins in and measure the distance apart, and I can watch the waves across the ceiling, and I can do wave speed, no problem, all day long. But I cannot show on an old standard ripple tank, you know, the sheet of glass with the light above it or below it, depending on how you run it. I've tried a strobe. I cannot show diffraction successfully. It just isn't obvious enough.
Yeah.
It just isn't obvious enough for a class. You know, and I've got a willing class of year 12s there who are keen to believe in it, and you can just see they don't believe it.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, my school purchased one of these little desktop ripple tanks where you can look down onto it, and it has a strobe that's automatically synchronized, and that works really, really well.
Oh, good. Okay,
so
yeah.
That kind of saved the day. But, of course, what I really do – I think every time I've taught waves since I found this, I just Google virtual ripple tank because it's so clear on the board and really, really shows things clearly. So it's just so frustrating. You know, you want to show it real. You want to show it really in front of them.
Well, I think two things there. First of all, if anybody's got any tips, first of all, how to get the ripple tank to work, there is a frustrated physics teacher who would be very, very keen to hear that. That's one thing. Secondly, you mentioned simulations, which reminds me of a thread I saw on Twitter this week, which was very funny. And it was all about, you know, if we'd sought fluid dynamics instead of electricity and, you know, what would it, we'd learn a lot about MOPS, I think, was the sort of upshot of it. But it was very funny. But that's kind of out of context. But the point was, it did end up pointing people at simulation. So I guess one of the things you do when your practical goes wrong or when you can't get it to work is to look for a simulation that you can show. The other thing, of course, is I mentioned videos earlier, you know, checking on videos. And again, sometimes you can show practicals on videos. I remember our protactinium generator broke down and we couldn't use it. But you go online and you can find a video. It's not as good as seeing it in real life, and we have to stress that practicals are better, but if nothing else is there, that might work.
It wasn't the only one that didn't work last week, and I think it's just very frustrating. The other thing, one of our excellent listeners bought a t-shirt at the.physicsteachingpodcast.com/shop. Mm-hmm. And I was chatting with him via email, and he sent me a infallible cloud chamber and a brilliant tip on making dry ice. You know, I've always avoided a cloud chamber unless I've been able to source dry ice. But if you talk to your site team, they will have redundant, out-of-date CO2 fire extinguishers, and you literally put a tote bag over the fire extinguisher and press it for 5 seconds, and you get a cup full of dry ice. Absolutely fantastic.
Perfect.
So I set up the cloud chamber exactly like in the sheet you sent me. Nothing.
No.
Nothing.
No.
I had the most beautiful rain of ethanol on alcohol falling inside it. It looked like it was going to work. It looked so perfect. The lighting, I was pretty sure about the lighting. Nothing.
Nothing.
I tried it 2 days in a row. I tried nothing. Just not a sausage. Not a sausage. I even brought a beta sauce to it to see if that would do anything. I wasn't sure if it would.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Just nothing. And it's so frustrating. I had my year, and it would have been a perfect lead into what I was doing with year 12. And I had them all watching it for, you know, through the lesson, in case we saw one event. You know, we wondered if it's because our ceiling tiles are metal and it was like a Faraday cage, so we put it under the skylight in case, you know, really basic stuff. I'm, you know, this is where me not being a pure physicist, me being a half engineer, I really suffer on this. And it was just so disappointing.
Yeah, Thomas, but how did the record tank not working, how did that make you feel? Yeah, I feel like it's turning into to counselling, but it's really interesting that you, as a seasoned physics teacher with a quarter of a century of physics teaching experience behind you, let's be honest, you know, you still hit this and still get this. And lest we forget, you know, practicals, that they are ropey things. They can go wrong. Things don't work, all these sorts of things. And experience over time is what gets you through. But you have to build that experience and you have to start somewhere. So, you know, what is it? It's those horrible motivational posters. There's no such thing as failure. There's just another opportunity to bounce back, isn't it?
Yeah, I think thinking about it, it's how you deal with it. I didn't really tell you about it to think about how I deal with it, but you know, how did I deal with the cloud chamber? I talked through the theory. We talked about a lot about what should be happening. We talked about why it was we needed dry ice. We talked about many things, and we just never got a result. But I suppose there was some good physics in it. The ripple tank was saved by the virtual ripple tank, of course.
Yeah, so the cloud chamber is where I'd reach for the video, because I'd sit there and say, well, this is what it's supposed to do, but you can look at this online and there'll be somebody who'll have put up an amazingly, beautifully, perfectly functioning version of the cloud chamber that you've just tried to build, which won't make you feel any better about life, but at least you'll show the kids, well, this is how it should look, you know. And I think kids, you know, they're pretty forgiving. They do. I've always found that if you're honest with them, you say, well, this didn't work, but this is what it should have done. They're okay with that. Like you say, it's not as good, but at least it's better than nothing.
Yeah, they certainly are forgiving. And they sensed my disappointment and frustration, I think. So, I mean, it doesn't put me off doing practicals, because nothing makes me happier than trying something different and it working really well. But you have to try. You have to try.
Yeah, and you're a very practically focused physics teacher, which is a good thing, a great thing.
Yeah, you say that. You say that, but I was challenged by Patrick Kaplow on this.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you talk a lot about practicals.
Mm.
Many people are going to be out there, particularly non-specialists, not teaching physics with practicals, and you're not doing anything to support them. And that's when I was reaching for my paper bag. I've done 25 years of teaching and basing every lesson exactly the same on introduce a practical, do the practical, learn from the practical, repeat, rinse and repeat. So that is a real challenge for me. I obviously do non-practical lessons, but... I'm not sure I'm a good source of advice for how to do it.
But that's exactly where I was coming, because I was kind of coming from a slightly different angle, and I suspect it's where Patrick's kind of thinking is. But it's to do with the thing that there are a lot of people who don't do practical work in the realm of physics. There are a lot of theoreticians. There are a lot of people who do computational physics now. There are a lot of people who do measurement and control. So there are an awful lot of people who never set foot in a laboratory in physics these days. And what about them? You know, what about them and their development and their share of the physics pie, so to speak? You know, that there will be times when perhaps, you know, theory does take to the fore. I always used to slightly feel this in radioactivity, because the way the radioactivity experiments were so prescribed and the fact that the kids couldn't really do anything apart from watch you demo them, I used to underplay the demos quite a lot, because it certainly wasn't a practical in any way, shape or form. It was just a demonstration. So I'd demo things loosely, but then get into the theory of alpha, beta, gamma and why they penetrate and what their nature is and these sorts of things, and thinking through those problems a lot more, much more quickly. I don't know about you.
My concern is, if I'm a non-specialist and I'm teaching non-practical, I, as a non-specialist, haven't got the background to do what you're talking about. When I'm talking about quarks and strange quarks and anti-strange quarks, and that's all stuff I've learned since I started teaching, but I'm interested, I've got the background, I can talk quite happily about it because I find it so fascinating. But if I'm a geography teacher who's been wheeled in to teach 11-year-olds physics, and I'm teaching them about electricity, and I know nothing about it, and I'm not doing a practical, I'm not sure I'm equipped to support them. How do you teach physics if you're not a specialist? How do you do it? I just take my hat off to these people who put in the line of fire.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like I say, I think these folks are heroes, because I remember what a hash I made of teaching biology and chemistry. Sorry to the countless children for whom chemistry and biology was not an option, because you'd been variously burnt, blown up, gassed, and generally upset by my strange version of biology and chemistry. Particularly my high point, which was when somebody was asking me what the equivalent of taste buds was for the sense of smell. And I think I did come up with the term nose buds, which, okay. Anyway, or smell buds, I think I call them. But anyway, yeah, so, but yeah, what do you do? Well, what would have got me past that would have been a little bit more reading around the subject. And that's an easy thing to say because there isn't often a lot of time. But I think the other thing is that I leveled with the kids and said, I'm not a specialist. So, you know, you will reach the limit of my knowledge pretty quickly. So, but I will promise to go away and find out if you've got a question I can't answer. I will go and ask the wonderful Miss Ogilvy, source of all wonderful knowledge on biology, because it was invariably biology, what the answer was.
Yeah, I think that was how I approached it. And I'm pretty good on biology, certainly to GCSE, but chemistry is my real weak point. I grew to love chemistry over the years of teaching it. I'd make it a journey of discovery with the kids. That I'm literally a page ahead of you in the textbook here.
Nice.
Most of the questions you ask, I won't know the answer to, but I am interested enough that I will go away and I will find out and we'll know next time. That's how I approached it.
That's lovely. That's enthusiasm for chemistry, even though that might be a little bit overstated or a little bit faked. You know, oh yeah, great, I'll go and find out. And you're just thinking, oh, that's another thing on the to-do list. But no, it is really good to sort of, and as you say, presenting it like we're both on the same side. I think that's one thing that I've heard non-specialists say quite a lot, that one big advantage they have is that they're on the same level of understanding as the kids almost, or slightly ahead. So therefore, they're much better able to understand their misconceptions and what they're having difficulty grasping, because it's very similar for them.
You do need to know the class, of course. And to make a journey with them, you've got to trust each other, haven't you?
Yeah.
And you have got to address those questions as you go. But I mean, my knowledge of chemistry was shocking when I started teaching.
Yes.
I left school with a C at O level chemistry.
Yeah.
We didn't have a teacher most of the time, funnily enough.
Mm.
And amazingly, although I won the school maths prize, later on in my life, I had no idea how to balance an equation. It made no sense to me. I didn't understand the periodic table and I didn't understand anything. And that was how I started teaching GCSE chemistry. Oh my God.
No, I did like chemistry, but even I realized that the bit I loved about chemistry was the physical chemistry and the things like, you know, sort of polar molecules and you know, electron densities and all this sort of stuff. Oh, it was really, really interesting stuff. And I did like that. So I did A-level in chemistry though. So I was all right.
Yeah. See, I did A-level biology. So I was fine with GCSE biology.
Organic chemistry used to find me out a bit though. Oh dear, oh dear. Yes. But it's good. But again, and I think, you know, when I did go into chemistry classes, I used to try and think, oh, have I got an anecdote? Can I say that? You know, do I know enough about this? And the other thing was never bluff it. You know, if a kid did find me out and ask me something I didn't understand, I'd just say, oh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I know the answer, but I'm not a proper chemist, but I'll go and find out for you and we'll know. So as you say, getting them on side and a voyage of discovery together is a really good tip.
I'd learned so much about chemistry through teaching it, obviously, and a lot of what I teach physics now is new stuff to me. I mean, there were no particle physics in my A-levels, and there wouldn't have been in yours. You know, 35 years ago. So I'd like to feel we could find a way to help non-specialists. I have no idea whether any listen to the podcast. I think given the listenership to the ways to teach electricity, I think we must be picking up a few. But please, if you're a non-specialist and you can think of something you'd like us to do, please contact us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com or Twitter @physicsdp, and let us know how we can help. We'd love to have some ideas. And if you are a physics teacher and you want to share something that you know helps, please contact us and come on the podcast.
Tell us your successes, because you will have had loads. And that's the thing, if you've taught it for any length of time. The other thing is that was the other thing I remember about teaching out a subject, was that you would, that when you had a success in a subject that wasn't yours, in some ways it was even more satisfying, because you thought, there's something that I started off really from square zero and have got some success there. So please share those successes with us. How did you effectively teach physics, and what tips have you got for hacking your life as a physics teacher, for spoofing it a little bit? That would be really useful.
There's this weird relationship, isn't there? When we started off and we had not very many listeners, we had people contacting us quite a lot with stuff they wanted to share. Now we're orders of magnitude higher. And people aren't contacting us. So don't think we're not interested. We'd love to hear from you. And we would love to get some more guests online. We have a few lined up, but we'd love to hear from you if you have things to share.
I do remember what that first half term of after Christmas was like, though. It's all mocking mocks and you're incredibly busy. So I do understand that. But if you could spare a few minutes just to let us know, we would really appreciate it. And we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get one of the vacuum cannon purchasers, Paul @PlanetReynolds on Twitter. He's been having some fun with that, but he also has a lot of other things he does up his sleeve. Another ex-engineer like Patrick.
Lovely. Well, no, it'd be great to hear from you. So if you do want to contact us, Twitter's proving very popular. It's at PhysicsTP.
We have a small following on Instagram, physics_teaching_podcast, because PhysicsTP was gone, even though it's a dormant account.
And of course, you can always get to all of these things via our wonderful, lovely website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com.
So do contact us. We'd love hearing from you. Please contact us and tell us what you're doing and tell us what works. It would be very lovely to hear from you.
Yes, you lovely, heroic people. It's over halfway through the year now. The days are getting longer and the sun was actually out today. It's lovely. And so please, please, please do get in touch with the Physics Teaching Podcast. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah, we are still building towards ways to teach distance, speed and acceleration, or displacement, velocity and acceleration. If you have something to share on that, please do. Thank you very much, Robin. Been fun.
Thank you, Thomas. Really excited about that distance, speed, acceleration one coming up. Oh, very good. Thank you for tonight. See you soon.
See you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast, and particular thanks to Nick Hood, who gave me the cloud chamber recipe. If anyone's got any tips how to make a cloud chamber work, I'd be delighted to hear them on Twitter at PhysicsTP. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.